With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, how using groundwater recharge is showing promise for a Central Valley farmer. But our top story today, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor says there have been several agricultural trade successes with export markets in 2023.
After decades of work, we've been able to expand to full market access for potato exporters into Mexico. Also, in February of this year, I met with Vietnamese government officials as we finalize access for U.S. grapefruit to the Vietnamese market. Last week, Canada approved the U.S. application for legislative recognition in its land use and biodiversity criteria under its clean fuel regulation. This recognition has actually been 6 years in the making when Canada first laid out this requirement and ensures that U.S. biodiesel and ethanol exports to Canada will continue, which will protect a nearly $3 billion U.S. export market. And just this week, actually, the People's Republic of China lifted high-path avian influenza-related import suspensions on 7 U.S. states.
Taylor was one of the speakers at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention last week. While at the NAFB convention, I talked with Alexis Taylor and got more on what's coming up in the coming year for specialty crops. As we were talking just before I turned on the recorder, I cover a lot of specialty crops, and I wanted to talk today about specialty crop trade. What are some things that you're excited about right now when it comes to trade and specialty crops?
So one of the things I'm really excited about is we just launched a specialty crop competitiveness initiative at USDA. Part of this is just a guide of all the resources that we have at USDA available to specialty crop producers from across the department. I think it's more than anybody really anticipated when we first said this is something we should be able to provide to our producers. But also, we are going to be doing a series of listening sessions around the country to really understand from an administrative perspective, what are some of the challenges and opportunities we have as a department to really fully support and leverage the programs and services we have to offer to our specialty crop sector. As part of that, we've also announced, as well as with some market development work internationally, we're doing a $100 million to support the specialty crop sector in some of the unique challenges they have to export products around the world. Oftentimes these are, while they're high value, agricultural sectors and parts of the state's agricultural economy, they're very small. There could be small acres or small number of producers. And so they don't have the sheer amount of resources that some of the larger commodity groups do. And so addressing some of those more technical barriers to trade that they experience in markets around the world is really important. And so that's why we are carving out $100 million from the Regional Agriculture Promotion Program, RAP, that we just announced to specifically support those producers in the challenges they're experiencing.
And this is so important to my listeners because my listeners are those producers that you just mentioned, whether it's the smaller producer that, you know, even grows just a few acres but of a highly specialized product, or if it's a grower who has many, many acres but still of a specialty crop product that doesn't have the same, you know, the same sheer numbers game as soy or wheat. So bringing these programs together and creating this for specialty crop producers, how much hard work has that been, and what all has gone into that?
Well, you know, it really hatched out of this small idea a few of us were talking about at USDA, and it's been a multi-departmental effort. So many agencies from across the department, from our local procurement programs to the research dollars we have, to the domestic farm support dollars, and then the programs I oversee, these trade and market development programs. And so really making sure all parts are working for the specialty crop sector, and we do want to really hear from our specialty crop producers on what more we can be doing, where are the gaps in our programs and services. This is going to be an iterative process. We're really excited about it because we know there are unique challenges. And just in what I oversee in the export market, we're really pleased to be able to target these $100 million. But the specialty crop sector also is going to be able to access the broader RAP program, and that's $1.3 billion total. And so excited that we can also continue some of that work. They're not just limited to that $100 million.
When we're talking about trade for specialty crops, you kind of alluded to it in your first response that there are different challenges, let's say, for specialty crops than for other bigger crops. What would be some, I mean, we use the terminology a lot, trade barriers, but what would be some of those challenges that growers face?
Well, so I think the challenges are compounded. So you have a highly perishable product and still dealing with the what we call sanitary and phytosanitary health and safety, things around pests, around diseases, making sure that ports are quick on entry, right? And the red tape is reduced so they have low barriers of entry are certainly some of those challenges that I think they experience that are more time sensitive. Prior to this role, I lived in Oregon for 6 years and worked in the agriculture sector. So very familiar with some of the specialty crops from the Pacific Northwest. And during cherry harvest, those cherries are getting flown to Asia, right? And having streamlined processes so when they hit the ground there, they can be same day on the grocery store shelves is so important. In this role earlier this year, I was actually in Vietnam and we finalized market access for U.S. grapefruit to be able to tap into the, to be able to access the Vietnam market. And so really excited. And so those are the types of things that we're working on these technical processes and really need to partner with industry. And we want to bring resources to our specialty crop industry to be able to tackle some of those challenges because we have a real small window of time often with our specialty crops actually getting in the door once they hit that market.
Is it okay if I ask about the 24 trade missions?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we offer as a service to our agricultural sector is trade missions. I've led 5 trade missions this year, and we have a new set of trade missions for 2024 coming out, and we're really excited about them. So in 2024, we'll be headed to Korea, India, Canada, Colombia, Vietnam with buyers from Thailand, and Morocco with buyers from Senegal and Francophone West Africa. And so really excited, I think, for specialty crop growers to look at these markets, see what is attractive and appealing to them based upon their products, and we really hope and invite them to come and join.
Thank you once again to Alexis Taylor for taking some time to chat with us. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more of the day's headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Randall Wiseman when we get back. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. In today's National Spotlight, 2023 has been a challenging year for U.S. agriculture. David Widmar, an economist with Agricultural Economic Insights, talks about some of the bigger stories this year in agriculture.
One of the big stories is declining net farm income. Big headline shocker there, but still historically high. So we've got to balance those two narratives. It's not been as good for all parts of the country. The Midwest and the Corn Belt have done really strong the last 3 years collectively. So 21, 22, 23 are the best 3-run average that we've had since the 40s. So the best 3 years in most of our careers. Now, on the other side of the narrative, we have commodity prices that have trended lower, especially on corn the last few years. Another year of below trend line yields. And of course, interest rates, really not necessarily the short-term rates that the Fed adjusts at their meetings, but we're really watching these long-term rates.
He says the volatility in ag will likely continue into 2024.
That's not necessarily all bad. As we talked about earlier, despite record high fertilizer prices, despite all the uncertainty around usage and demand and inflation, the farm economy had a good run between 2011 and 2023. We might see some reversion to the mean, whereas net farm incomes could again be lower, but not necessarily historically bad. We got to realize that both at the farm level and at the sector level, the last 3 years are not normal. They're not normal in terms of amount of government payments. They're not normal in terms of commodity prices or profitability. So we need to start recalibrating expectations for what's normal and what should we plan on.
And he says there are factors producers need to watch for when making decisions ahead of the 2024 growing season in the Midwest.
Well, one of the things we're going to keep an eye on is acreage. There's always an acreage reallocation. And one of the things that happened in 2023, and our observation is that we had a lot of corn acres and a little bit of soybean acres, and that's resulted in this imbalance in the ending stocks. So corn ending stocks are above the long run average, closer to 15% instead of the average of 13. Soybeans are closer to 5 or 6% instead of the long run average of 8. So we need to see some acreage reallocation. So producers are going to need to keep an eye on that relative price ratio and how that's going to impact their budgets. Also keeping an eye on fertilizer expenses. Fertilizers came down a lot. That's going to really benefit corn budgets quite a bit.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's livestock report.
Well, in today's livestock news, the USDA did release their November cattle on feed report, and it shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. for feedlots with a capacity of 1,000 or more head was at 11.9 million head on November 1st. That's 2% above November 1 of 2022. And as Gary Crawford reports, it indicates the beef cattle herd contraction is still going on.
The number of cattle, especially heifers, being sent to slaughter or to feedlots has continued to increase over the last few months, and one analyst says, of course,
higher cow slaughter and higher placements now, it just means that even further down the line, it's going to continue to tighten up supplies.
So much so that for 2024, USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski says,
what we are expecting to see for the coming year is a fairly sharp reduction year over year in beef production, so down about 1 billion pounds.
Or about a 4% decline in production at 25.8 billion pounds. And that, of course, is likely to bring on what Mark calls
really very historically high steer prices.
USDA currently projecting steer prices next year to average almost $185 a hundredweight. That would be up 4% from the already high prices we've been seeing this year. Consumer beef prices are already running about 9% higher than a year ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. The report also shows that placements in feedlots during October at 2.16 million head was up 4% from last year. Net placements at 2.11 million head. During the month of October, placements of cattle and calves weighing less than 600 pounds were 550,000 head. 600 to 699 pounders, 470,000 head. 700 to 799 pounders at 465,000 head. Placements of 800 to 899 pounders at 394,000 head. 900 to 999 pounders were at 205,000 head, and those 1,000 pounds and greater were at 80,000 head. The report notes that marketings of fed cattle during October at 1.76 million head was 3% below last year. And the Environmental Protection Agency published a Federal Register notice last week establishing the Animal Agriculture Water Quality Subcommittee. It's under the umbrella of the Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee. Nominations are open for members who want to serve on that subcommittee. The primary subcommittee goal will be to develop recommendations that will inform the agency's decisions regarding how to improve the implementation of the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System's Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation Permitting Program. That program is designed to reduce nutrients and other types of water pollutants more effectively from animal feeding operations. EPA says it's committed to working with stakeholders, advocates, communities, and industry to explore how to achieve water quality improvements related to CAFOs. The EPA is accepting those subcommittee nominations until January 2nd and welcomes nominations from a diverse range of qualified candidates. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news right at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news, and with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Nutrien recently published a study titled Bridging the Agricultural Perception Divide, shedding light on the perceptual disparities between North American farmers and consumers regarding sustainability, technology, and land usage. Drawing responses from more than 600 farmers and 3,000 consumers in the U.S. and Canada, the study identifies environmental stewardship, industry advancement, social responsibility, and societal support for farmers as key areas with substantial differences in perception. Interestingly, both farmers and consumers agree that agriculture has a tremendous amount of potential to shape a sustainable future. However, the widest perception gaps are observed in environmental stewardship and industry advancement. The study also indicates that 60% of consumers have a desire to learn more about the industry. The full study is available at nutrien.com/agperceptions. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit has declared California's glyphosate warning mandated by Proposition 65 as unconstitutional. The ruling followed a six-year legal challenge by ag groups against the labeling requirements for glyphosate. The court, in a 2-1 decision, sided with the plaintiffs, asserting that the warning violated their First Amendment rights to free speech. A central issue in the case was the information used as a basis requiring a carcinogen warning under Prop 65. EPA deemed it non-carcinogenic, while the International Agency for Research on Cancer labeled it, quote, probably carcinogenic. The court emphasized that Prop 65 warnings must be based on a strong scientific consensus to avoid being deemed controversial. The ruling was welcomed by ag groups who argued the labeling requirements posed a threat to glyphosate usage by promoting false and misleading information on its safety. Biological materials are showing promise in protecting against grapevine trunk disease pathogens. Cooperative Extension Specialist in Plant Pathology, Akif Eskelin, said they looked at several options for protecting pruning wounds in grapevines.
One of them is Biotem, which has two Trichoderma species together. Another one is the Vintec, which is also available. One Trichoderma product we also included. The sealant, Vintec, we also want to include some other biocontrol agent, Bacillus species and everything. We want to see what is available, what we can do about that. And then we try all of those to the experiment that we are done with the nurseries. And indeed, some of those biologicals and preventative measures competed with the synthetic pesticides. That means they are as good as the other synthetic known pesticides.
A grower in Madeira is having success with groundwater recharge efforts in orchards and vineyards. Fifth-generation farmer Jennifer Markarian-Peters said that whenever canal water is available for recharge, they take it.
So in January, when that becomes available, we flood everything. And it'd be kind of silly to not do it. I mean, you might not be able to get in there to spray an herbicide or whatever right away, but the benefit of the water going in far surpasses a weed that can get killed when the ground dries up a little bit. So we take it. We've been doing that. I've been out here for 13 years, and my dad, obviously, a lot longer than that, and that's always been the practice. When the water is at a rate that we can afford, it goes everywhere. And then during irrigation season, we just take it. We don't care what the rate is. It's got to go in. And, you know, we are solar, so it would be cheaper to pump, but it's not cheaper to have to treat water and all that kind of stuff. So it's just better to shut everything off and go with the canal water.
UC Cooperative Extension will be hosting the 24th annual Fall Desert Crops Workshop next week in Imperial. The workshop will begin at 8 a.m. on Thursday, November 30th in the Ag Center room at Ag West Farm Credit Services. Imperial County Deputy Ag Commissioner Nelson Perez will open the workshop with a presentation on pest detection efforts in the county. The rest of the morning will cover nitrogen water use efficiency in desert carrots, biosolarization, root knot nematode management approaches, and soil health management in low desert vegetables. Following the morning break, there will be presentations on the biology and management of fusarium wilt in lettuce, aphid control in low desert alfalfa, and Sudan grass nitrate concentration and livestock feeding recommendations. More information on the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Thank you, Brian. The USDA and U.S. Forest Service are continuing work to mitigate western wildfires. Here's Rod Main.
Combating what has been a trend of increased wildfire activity in the western U.S. That was a subject of discussion at the recent Western Governors Association winter meeting in Wyoming. As Utah Governor Spencer Cox noted,
the single most important thing we can do is better forest management.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack offered insight to current U.S. Forest Service efforts regarding management of our nation's forest and, in turn, mitigating wildfires.
I want to assure you that we remain committed to our wildfire crisis strategy. I'm pleased to note that in our first year of operation in fiscal year 22, we did about 3.2 million acres of treatment. Our last fiscal year that just ended in September of this year, we increased that to 4.2 million acres, so a million acre increase. We're looking at primary fire sheds, which we know create great risk. We think the work that we're doing is helping to protect 550 communities, 1,800 watersheds, and 2,500 miles of power lines that are so important to the resiliency and the effectiveness and economic opportunity in western states.
He adds additional focus will also be on increased efforts and personnel in the realm of wildfire management.
Continue to look at ways in which we can utilize resources in reforestation as well. We have a major issue and a challenge in terms of making sure that our wildfire fighters are well paid and adequately paid. We're also addressing the issue of housing as well as mental health support for these brave men and women who are fighting every single day to protect our communities and our natural resources.
The secretary also provided his thoughts on one hurdle regarding forest management, National Environmental Policy Act project reviews, and legal challenges to NEPA rulings that delay project implementation.
Congress basically gave us the capacity to utilize emergency powers for NEPA, which allows us to, in essence, fast-track that process without sacrificing the quality of the assessment, but to be able to do it on a much more streamlined timeline.
Secretary Vilsack says he believes the NEPA fast track for forest management projects is working well. He then poses another question.
Is that something that could potentially be utilized in other circumstances? And if so, what would they be?
Yet he acknowledges
the challenge is no matter what you do, somebody always disagrees with it. And you have litigation. And sometimes it's litigation because people think you should be doing more. And sometimes people think you should be doing a heck of a lot less. Until you deal with the issue of litigation and trying to figure out ways to streamline it in a way that doesn't interfere with the quality of the analysis and assessment, you're going to continue to be stuck with taking forever for things to get done.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The agriculture industry has been one of the biggest supporters of the AM for Every Vehicle Act since its introduction. Radio Inc. says the industry has spending power of more than $576 billion spread across millions of workers. MRI Simmons, the leading study of American consumer attitudes and behaviors, explored the media choices of agricultural workers. Those workers are big audio consumers, with more than half qualifying as heavy listeners. They listen to audio 60% more than the internet and 51% more than television. At the other end of the medium spectrum, close to half of all ag workers fall into the light user category for internet and TV, and outnumber the heavy users. 8 in 10 ag workers favor AM/FM and tune into radio ahead of streaming audio, podcasts, and satellite radio. The heavy audio usage is likely because of the fact that it is an everywhere media with easy access. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Why Thanksgiving is not quite as important as it used to be for the turkey industry, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. The turkey industry is less dependent on holiday whole bird sales these days, USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum explains.
I mean, the turkey industry has diversified in terms of providing more products, either in the sense of ground turkey meat as an option to typical ground beef or ground pork. They've made inroads in terms of providing turkey products for the deli case. So to some extent, the whole bird that we normally think of as being that center item for turkey producers has diminished somewhat over time. We've also seen, you know, as families have gotten smaller, folks are moving to breast meat. To the whole breast is an option.
However, he says Thanksgiving does remain important to the industry. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West. A Turkish bath is fine, but not a turkey bath. Gary Crawford tells us why.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath.
Ah, yes, Bobby Darin's hit from 1958. Of course, for me, a bath wouldn't be a bad idea, but for a turkey, very bad idea.
We don't recommend to wash poultry.
That's Meredith Carruthers with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline. Now, a lot of people like to take that turkey, plop it in the sink, give it a shower, wash it down good, thinking that would wash off any dirt or bacteria that might be on it. But like the song says,
splish, splash,
that water can splash and splatter all over the place, sending that bacteria with it.
That, if spread in multiple places, could then become a major cross-contamination risk if you're then going to prepare a salad or something that's ready to eat in the same environment.
Meredith says proper cooking will take care of the bacteria on the bird, but if the bacteria has been splattered on the counter or nearby foods or utensils, you got a problem. You need to disinfect the sink and any place that wash water might have touched, including your hands. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The West Virginia Norway spruce, selected as this year's U.S. Capitol Christmas tree, is part of a months-long tour of its home state prior to arriving at its final destination. Rod Bain reports.
When it comes to the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree, Amy Albright of the U.S. Forest Service in West Virginia, among those associated with this year's tree, says,
the U.S. Capitol Christmas Tree Project is truly a year-long effort. We've been celebrating Christmas since last Christmas here in West Virginia.
And the celebration continues in November. It started the first day of the 11th month with the harvesting of the 63-foot Norway spruce. On a wintry, almost Christmassy day in the Monongahela National Forest near Elkins, West Virginia. Once it was loaded on an extra-long trailer, the tree named Wethomtekwi, Bright Star in the language of the Shawnee Tribal Nation, visited Elkins to start
about a two-week tour
with stops all around the tree's home state. Albright says the stops allowed for Forest Service employees to conduct outreach with members of local communities, a continuation of education and awareness about the Capitol Christmas tree and our nation's forest.
We have had staff out in schools all year talking to school children about national forests and maybe what makes national forests different than other public lands that they might be familiar with. We've been attending public events.
Children in the Mountaineer State also took part in what is a traditional aspect of the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree celebration.
To help us make up to 10,000 handmade ornaments that would help represent what makes West Virginia endlessly wild and wonderful. And they really, really pulled through.
Such ornaments will adorn not just the Capitol Christmas tree, but several companion trees from West Virginia placed in and decorated at multiple federal buildings in the nation's capital area. The 19-stop tour comes to a close with the arrival of Wethomtekwi at the Capitol grounds the third week of November.
At that point, we pass the tree off to the architect of the Capitol, and they will light the tree, decorate it with all of the ornaments that we are providing.
November 28th is the scheduled date for the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree lighting ceremony. More details about this year's Capitol Christmas tree, its journey, and a history of the Capitol Christmas Tree Program can be found at this web address, www.uscapitolchristmastree.com. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. For today's interview, I'm talking with Stephen Finneroli, Director of Political Affairs with the California Farm Bureau. Well, Stephen, can you start out with just telling me a little bit about yourself and your background? Introduce yourself to our listeners.
So I guess, yeah, a little bit about me, and thank you for, you know, having me on. I grew up in Northern California. You know, I spent summers with my parents who worked at a tomato processing plant. And when they were, you know, working long shifts over the summer, you know, when couldn't find babysitters or whatnot, you know, the conference room kind of became our daycare. And so I spent summers kind of growing up around tomatoes, around ag, and it was always just fun. I'd go, you know, visit my mom in the lab, and somehow I convinced, you know, some of the folks there to let me work the dumpers. I don't know that I should have been running a dumper when I was like 8 years old, but, you know, despite that, I grew up kind of loving ag. And I think, you know, to me, you know, my folks are still in the area. And, you know, to me, tomato harvest, just like the smell of it is, you know, it's kind of addictive, and you drive, you know, down these county roads, you know, late at night, and the only lights on, you know, are these tomato harvesters, right? And you can kind of smell them. And so it's just, it brings back kind of, nostalgic memories. And, you know, I got to Farm Bureau about 2 years ago, and it's been a great time. And I, you know, in terms of kind of doing something that you love, and, you know, going to work every day and, you know, wanting to actually kind of, you know, believe in what you do, you know, I think that ag is, you know, for me is right at the top of my list. And, you know, you look at not just Farm Bureau members, right? That's kind of too small of a subset, but just kind of all ag and, you know, whatever that means to folks. But I think, you know, it's probably, you're not going to find a harder working group of people. You're not going to find, you know, people who, you know, a group of folks who don't understand kind of the way that the world works, from, you know, government to the cost of doing business. And so I just, it's been, you know, eye-opening on many levels, but I think the big thing for me, the most rewarding thing for me, has been just the people, right? And I think that they make it incredibly worthwhile. And, you know, and I guess coming from, you know, not the most intensive ag background. You know, I'm not afraid to just go and ask some of my members, you know, hey, tell me more about what you do. And I find it really exciting and, you know, really, really nice just to learn about, you know, the different things that, you know, the industries that we have in California. And, you know, I get to travel across the country for Farm Bureau and, you know, getting to make those connections and then getting to hear kind of the differences between, you know, different commodities throughout different states and whatnot. And so, you know, it's just, I'd say rewarding on many different levels.
So you talked a little bit about some of the things that you get to do at Farm Bureau now, but what does your position really involve there at Farm Bureau?
So that's a great question. And I think, you know, I kind of live in the space as political director where, you know, I get to kind of do a few different things. So, you know, we have a state government affairs team and they, you know, work kind of just directly in the Capitol. They work on, you know, lobbying. And then we have a federal affairs team as well, and they do the same thing kind of in D.C. And I kind of live in that space in between to where, you know, if we need to launch kind of a public affairs campaign on a certain bill, you know, that's kind of my background. And I think, you know, going back to kind of why and how I ended up at Farm Bureau. So I, you know, my first job out of college, well, I guess let's even go back, right? So, you know, I lived in D.C. for a while. I worked on the Hill, and that was, you know, kind of eye-opening. I think I got a love for politics at an early age. My high school government teacher, you know, while we didn't agree politically, I think one bit, you know, we spent a couple weeks just like reading through the Constitution. And I think as nerdy as that sounds, you know, he kind of really gave me a love and a, you know, kind of opened up my eyes to, you know, how exciting government can be. And so that's kind of where, you know, I went in with a, you know, kind of that beginning appetite for politics. And so, you know, I did the DC thing for a while and that was fun. But I think when it came down to it, right, I wanted to move back to California. You know, my folks were here. And so, you know, I worked straight out of college. I worked campaigns for a little bit. I worked in the California Capitol for two different Senate minority leaders and kind of got, you know, a little bit of an, you know, some insight on the legislative process, you know, kind of the whole, you know, what it takes for a bill to become a law. And I think it's so funny, you know, we in, you know, middle school, right, we all kind of learn the, you know, the song about how a bill becomes a law. And, you know, it's so funny because that in reality probably couldn't be farther from the truth. But it was, you know, it was a great experience and the people that you meet there and, you know, the relationships that you form and kind of the understanding of, you know, hey, how the sausage is actually made, you know, I think kind of not only opened my eyes, but gave me a deeper and more grateful understanding for everything. So then after that, you know, I said, hey, I want to go and, work, you know, do more in kind of that campaign life. I kind of was doing it a little bit on the side. So I worked, doing kind of statewide, we had candidates, we had, you know, local ballot measures, we had statewide ballot measures, we had a few, national kind of races that we would work on. And so that kind of, you know, that hustle and that deadline of saying, hey, by election day, you know, we either know that we've won or lost, you know, that was something that I think I really identified with, and kind of knowing, you know, what that success looked like, right? And kind of can we quantify that? So that was a, you know, fantastic kind of period of my life and, you know, really developed some friendships there and learned a lot from, you know, my mentors there. And then that kind of brought me to Farm Bureau. So I think kind of using that background, that knowledge of running campaigns.
We are going to take a quick break, and then we will continue talking with Stephen Fenaroli. And remember, if you'd like to hear this interview again or any of our news programs again, you can tune into our podcast. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast listening app. We will be right back. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. We continue talking with Stephen Fenaroli, Director of Political Affairs with the California Farm Bureau.
You know, Farm Bureau has, you know, just a tremendous number of members, you know, kind of throughout the state, right? And everybody's doing different, you know, different forms of ag, you know, one of the 400 specialty crops or, you know, whatever folks are working on. And so I think that just kind of goes to say all of the differences that, you know, we have to kind of work through. And so for me at Farm Bureau, I live in that different space and kind of finding, you know, hey, how can we be effective? How can we, you know, make an impact? And so I think it's great that we're actually talking, you know, right now in this period. So in California, at least the period, if you wanted to run for either federal office, state office, or if you want to run for a county position, you know, the period to file and to actually, you know, put your name in the hat is, you know, now through the beginning of December. And so that's all stuff that I keep, you know, a close eye on. Farm Bureau does our own candidate school. And, you know, while we're not, you know, we're party agnostic, right? We're not Republican. We're not Democrat. You know, the goal isn't about electing more of one party. It's about electing, you know, people who will advocate for agriculture at the end of the day. And I think that's, you know, kind of full stop. We have, you know, a number of kind of different facets, you know, in there that, you know, I can dive into a little bit more. We have a political action committee called Farm PAC that was started in the 70s. And that, you know, is all, you know, donations from members who they say, yeah, no, I, you know, I am committed. I am motivated in making sure that farmers and ranchers have a voice, not only in Sacramento, but in Washington, D.C. And so that helps us, you know, run different races. It helps us support candidates, you know, who at the end of the day are going to be supportive of ag. And, you know, I think I would just mention that, you know, California is kind of a tough state to be in, you know, in regards to that. You know, the way that the registration for voters breaks out in California is it's about 50% Democrats, 25% Republicans, and then 25% declined a state. And so those are folks that kind of, you know, it's the no party preference, the, you know, what we would think of as independent voters. And, you know, so again, and as I kind of meet with, you know, different candidates, you know, before elections or after, you know, heading into the 2022 election, and now again before the 2024 election, it's really evident that a lot of these folks who are running for office, you know, kind of throughout the state, they just don't know a lot about agriculture. You know, I'll sit down and I'll ask them, you know, hey, what do you know about water rights? And they kind of just have this blank stare on their face. And so I think a lot of it, you know, is educating, and again, just kind of trying to develop those relationships and knowing that, you know, hey, we're not always going to agree, but, you know, somebody that we agree with 80% of the time, you know, is somebody who's a friend. And, you know, where can we find common ground? Where can we establish, you know, that 80%? And so I think, you know, that's been really critical. That's kind of how I look at my role at Farm Bureau is, you know, where can we develop, you know, more of those partnerships? You know, how can we find folks that we, you know, align with on, you know, maybe a few issues, and how can we kind of build different coalitions? So that's kind of, you know, another piece of it is kind of that, you know, outward, you know, facing external affairs piece. And again, just how can we make Farm Bureau, you know, more powerful? What else would I think I'd tell you? You know, so going back to, so that's kind of the Farm PAC piece. We have another kind of program that I manage, and it's called Farm Team. And what that is we take all of our members, so all Farm Bureau members, but then we open it up to other folks and just say, you know, hey, do you want to, you know, contact your legislator on a certain issue? And so this year, I want to say we did, you know, upwards of 20 campaigns, you know, on different, you know, California state legislation. We did it on, you know, some state regulations. We did it on federal, you know, some regulation as well. And so what that is, you know, they, members and folks who want to sign on, they get on the platform. It's all via email. You know, it's a couple of clicks. It takes probably just a minute. And they get to say, you know, hey, yeah, I am, you know, a farmer and rancher in, you know, Merced or Madera County, wherever they live. And, you know, I want my legislator to know that I am, you know, either supportive or, you know, opposed to this legislation. And I'm really excited. You know, we had over 25,000 emails go out to, you know, different folks on, you know, issues that matter to farm, you know, to ag, 25,000 emails that went out, you know, via folks that, you know, care about ag in the state. And so, you know, I think to me, if not just Farm Bureau members, but if folks aren't using their voice, you know, then we are going to be, you know, just kind of not heard in that arena, right?
Once again, we are talking this morning with Stephen Fenaroli from the California Farm Bureau. He is the Director of Political Affairs. That is all the time that we have this morning, but we will continue talking with Stephen Fenaroli on tomorrow's show, so make sure that you tune in. That wraps up today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.